Hi, everybody. I'm Helen Turnquest, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's wonderful to be here. I think, first of all, I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come. It's the first time in my life I've ever been south, and what they say about southern hospitality is really true. Now, maybe this isn't the deep south, but it's south for me, and I'm just really delighted to be here. All of the other staff members who have had the opportunity to come before I have said you'll love those people in West Virginia. They are really something special. And that's what's been shown to me this weekend, and for that I'm very, very grateful. Someone asked me just before I walked in, was I nervous? And then H.M. was sitting back there, you know, with his hands trembling like mine used to in the morning when I got up, before I had the first drink. And I thought, nervous? I said, you know, they talk about all these little butterflies we have flying around here, you know, in the Al-Anon room. I have eagles flying around, but that's okay. That what I was told when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous was that I shared my experience, strength, and hope. That what it was like, what it used to be like, what it's like now, what happened and what it's like now. Well, let me tell you, it's a heck of a lot different today than it was almost 6 years ago. I was one of those people who didn't take to AA right away. I stayed sober for about 6 weeks when I was first introduced to it. And then feeling on, you know, really tip-top shape and on top of the world and the life had become somewhat manageable again, I picked up a drink. But I didn't drink for too long, just long enough for the shakes to come back, for the blackouts to start, and for the calling in sick again to work. 3 weeks. But it didn't take that long. It only took about maybe a week after I picked up the first drink for everything to come back. But I thank God that the path was shown to me, because coming back to AA, there were a lot of things in my life that when I failed at them or I didn't do them as perfectly as I wanted to do them, I dropped it, never to return again. So I do thank my God for allowing me to find the path again to come back to AA, because even though I picked up that drink, I had some sort of sense from somewhere that this was the place for me. I won't bore you with a drunkalogue of what my life was like as a kid. I think I can sum it up in two words. I was an egotist with an inferiority complex. And that tells it all. And not only my childhood, but I guess the majority of my life. I bluffed my way through a lot of things. I was frightened to death of life. I was one of those kids who wanted to be a lot of things. But I never wanted to do what I had to do in order to become any of them. I wanted to, or things to miraculously develop. Like I wanted to be a doctor for as long as I can remember. But I didn't want to go through the steps that it took in order to be a doctor. I wanted, you know, like Marcus Welby, the white jacket and the stethoscope too, like that. Well, when it didn't come easily, as I said, I just kind of dropped things and went on to something else. I was a perfectionist. I've heard this so often. I was one of those kids who wanted to be good, who wanted to be the best, and who fantasized an awful lot. I came along in the late 30s. I lived my life in the 40s during the war, as many people did, and I found myself immediately identifying with the first speaker I heard because he talked about living in the movies and patterning his life after the lives he saw on the silver screen. And that was what I wanted my life to be like. My family had said I was special, and indeed weren't those people on the screen special. You know, they wore the pretty dresses and danced these wonderful dances, and they all drank out of these stem glasses. And that was my idea of adulthood. Nothing else. That was my idea of adulthood. And that's what I strove to do. I did all right in school. I was born in the Midwest. There was drinking in my family. I came to find out when I came to AA that there was alcoholism in my family. But we didn't call it that. We called it, you know, Aunt Ruth is weak-willed. You know, if she'd just get her act together, she could really be okay. My cousin was really, literally and figuratively, the black sheep of my family, so we kind of swept him under the carpet, you know. And didn't talk about him too much. And he died from alcoholism, as did my aunt. At any rate, drinking was a natural thing for me. And when I drank, there was a difference in my drinking than from any of my peers. You know, I began drinking periodically I'd have a little wine at Christmas. You know, they'd let you have a little taste of something over the holiday time. And when I was a teenager, and whenever I had the opportunity to drink, I did drink, because so did my friends. But there was something different about mine. I had a hollow leg, and one drink didn't do anything except give me the desire for another one. And the second one just whet my appetite for a third. And that's the story of my drinking career, is that one did not do anything at all. I could drink anyone under the table. I didn't think at those times I had any trouble drinking, but thinking back on it now being sober, there was a fellow I was dating at that time, and he said, "Don't you ever have just one?" And I thought, well, what in God's name is one drink? You know, you're drinking those Tom Collins or whiskey sours. It was just fruit juice anyway. But one never did anything for me. But after about the third, it did wonderful things for me. I was no longer shy. I began to have a sense of humor. I didn't trip over my tongue. I really kind of thought I was the greatest thing since Scotch tape, you know, after about the third drink. And one other thing it did, because I really was a shy kind of introverted gal. I won't say that I was withdrawn, but I was shy and I was rather introverted. And booze did wonderful things in bringing out a personality. I could even dance. You know, I frequently say that not all of us are born with rhythm. And I was one of those who wasn't. It took some scotch or gin or bourbon or whatever it was to bring out a little bit of rhythm that I wouldn't trip over my feet out on the dance floor. But life just really kind of went along this way. I left Chicago in 1957 to go to New York to school. And drinking was not a part of my life. But I have frequently heard that alcoholism is a disease of the attitudes. And my attitudes were definitely alcoholic back in those days, right from the time I can remember, from wanting to be perfect, not standing anyone who didn't measure up to my idea of perfection, of being very materialistic. I was very label conscious and very title conscious. I said that today, that if you had some letters after your name, then you were okay. You could be the biggest SOB around, but if you had some letters after your name, then you were all right in my book. And this was the way I patterned my life. Things just kind of went along, and drinking was a part, and it wasn't a part. I suffered from blackouts back in those days. I ran for a lot of class offices back in those days, and I won them, because it was kind of a people-pleasing setup that I got into, that if I did this well, having no self-esteem, really, you know, as I said, I was an egotist with an inferiority complex, and that if I was a class officer, or if I was something else, then I thought people would like me, that it was necessary for me to be those things in order to be liked. When I graduated from school, I stayed in New York for a couple of years, and at that time, my older sister and her husband had moved from the Midwest out to Los Angeles, and they had been badgering me to come out and live there and kind of make my fortune, perhaps find somebody and get married. And finally, I relented to this, and I went out. And thinking back on it now, I think that this is where I crossed that so-called invisible line. From whatever social drinking I didn't think about booze back in those days every day. But when I got out to Los Angeles, it was a pattern of my sisters and my brother-in-law's, and I lived with them while I was there, to have a drink or two when they got home from work. And boy, did that fit into the picture I had of sophisticated living. You know, that was true sophistication and chicness, to have a cocktail when you get home from work. You know, it took away the tiredness of the day, the legs that I had been standing on all day and running, the feet I had been running around with all day, no longer hurt. I was relaxed. And lo and behold, it was a very insidious and very progressive thing that happened. I went from one to a couple to maybe a few before dinner, to having a drink with dinner, and to having drinks after dinner. Somebody I was dating quite seriously out there at that time said to me, "Helen, don't you drink anything else but scotch?" And I thought, well, who wants Coca-Cola? Or who wants coffee or tea? How mundane that is. You know, I was always trying to stay on that plane that maybe the second or third drink put me on. So I would keep drinking. But then I would always, I couldn't find it. I just couldn't seem to recapture that plane ever again until maybe the next day when I started once more. Well, no sooner did he say that to me that he was 86th out of my life, as everybody else was who commented on my drinking. But then my sister began to comment that the level on the scotch bottle seemed to be going down very rapidly. So this kind of led to a number of arguments. It led to a lot of sneakiness, which I know a lot of you would identify with, where I would take the bottle and run it under the faucet and try and raise the level a bit on the bottle. Well, you know, you do that enough times with scotch, and it comes out looking like gin, you know something's wrong. And when she went to pour a glass of scotch and it came out looking like gin, we had a big fight, and I said, well, I'm going back to New York. And that was my solution to all problems, not to face them, not to talk about them, but to run away from them and maybe have a drink over them, that the solution would come, you know, like some Sermon on the Mount. After about the second drink, the solution to the problem would come. So I came back to New York, and I brought with me a daily habit of drinking. Few clothes, few other little things, but mainly I brought a daily habit of drinking. And I fell in with a drinking crowd. And I fell in with what I thought was a very sophisticated crowd. They were people I was working with. I happened to be a nurse by profession. And these were a bunch of medical people. Some were from Europe, some were from South America, some were from really all over. And they kind of taught me a lot of the things that I really wanted to learn about. Living, and cooking, and wines, and liqueurs, and the right glasses for any of these things. And we would, you know, kind of run around from apartment to apartment with dinner parties. And I had to learn how to, I had to reciprocate, because you can't just go to somebody's house and eat their food and not have them over to your place. So I bought a few cookbooks, and I went through what I call my gourmet cooking phase. Everything marinated in something, from the appetizer to the dessert. And while it was marinating, I was marinating right along with it, because I had my trusty little scotch bottle in the kitchen, or I would sip a little bit of the wine before I pour it on something to make sure it was okay, you know, that it was good quality stuff, or to sip a little bit of the brandy that I was going to flame something in to make sure that was all right. Well, again, the insidious progression of the disease caught up with me, because where I had been maybe slightly high by the time people arrived, I went from that kind of high, giddy phase into being slightly drunk and not really eating the food. I was able to serve it, but I couldn't really, you know, I'd say I'm full from tasting, but I'll drink the wine, to the point where that's all I would do, would be to drink the wine and then excuse myself and say how tired I was from the day, that I just want to go stretch out for a little bit, and then I pass out. Guests would have to clean up. You know, I'd wake up sometime 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and everybody's gone, dining room table was clean, dishes in the dishwasher, and I couldn't imagine how it all happened. I didn't remember what had happened. But then there came the day that my doorbell rang, and I was in what I call my little drunken moo-moo. It was a Christmas present that my brother was kind enough to send me one year, and it was one of those soft velour things, you know, and it really was a moo-moo kind. It hid everything, you know. And it never saw water. It had a lot of spill. It may have had some spills of water on it, but it never really saw water. And it was as stiff as a board. You know, if you took it off, you could really kind of put it in the corner and it would stand up by itself. And that had become my drinking outfit. You know, I'd get home from work and I'd whip that thing on and I'd have one, you know, just to unwind, and that one would just, you know, lead on to a bottle of booze. And I was in this and I was stretched out, recovering from my day at work, and the doorbell rang. And it gave me a sense of panic that I hope I never again have in my life, where the heart started to palpitate, and you know you look like hell, and you wonder now who could that be, and it's only 7 o'clock at night, and you're already in a terrible state. And I said, "Who is it?" And there were two of the nurses that I worked with telling me that I had invited them for dinner. And I didn't remember it. I did not remember it. And I wouldn't let them in, because all I had left was a half a bottle of scotch, and I wasn't about to share that with anybody. And I told them to go away, that I had some sort of contagious disease and that I wouldn't be at work the next day. And it began another period for me in my life, and that was one from where I took pride in the job that I did and prided myself on getting to work all of the time. I didn't suffer from hangovers too badly up until that point. And the hangovers then began. And as they began, so did my absenteeism from my job. Now, being the true alcoholic that I was, I got promoted. I got promoted into a supervisory position. And I didn't know a thing about supervision. I guess maybe they thought that it would be the best to keep me away from the patients and just give me paperwork. But what it did was to give me a sense of really feeling isolated from my staff and isolated from everyone, because, again, the perfectionism took over, where people were not doing what I wanted them to do, and I alienated the staff. The alcoholic attitudes took over. And finally, after a couple of years in that job, I resigned. And I went to work for a man that I said I had a great deal of respect for, and indeed I do today. And when I found out he was looking for a nurse, I thought that this was the best job I could possibly get. He was a surgeon that I think just has golden hands. And it didn't hit me until I got into the program that the reason I left the job I had to go and work for him was because my time would really be my own, that I wouldn't have to work weekends, that I would be off work at a certain time every day, and that I wouldn't come in contact with a lot of people who were after, quote, my job. That it would just allow me to be able to manage my life a bit better than I was able to manage it while working at the hospital. Well, needless to say, you know, I mean, I lived in California for 2 years. I was in a supervisory job for 2 years. Then I went and worked for a doctor for 2 years. I had geographics every 2 years, trying to find the niche for me. And I could never find it. I kept looking and looking and looking, and I couldn't find it. And in about 1971 was when the physical symptoms of withdrawal set in, where one afternoon my hand started to shake. And of course we all attributed that to anxiety, and anxiety over what I didn't really know. But someone suggested I take one of those little yellow pills called Valium. And I did. And the shaking stopped. And it began 3 years then of insidious, progressive use of Valium, from about 5 milligrams a day up to about 60 milligrams a day. But I used it purely medicinally. Purely medicinally. I would take 10 upon awakening in the morning, 10 milligrams around 1, and 10 around 7 that night. I was deathly afraid of pills, but 5 milligrams wouldn't do it anymore. I had to take the double dose. And so, I can say I'm cross-addicted, but I took it for the 3 years. Booze was really my drug of choice. At any rate, what happened, I believe, really accelerated then the progression of my alcoholism, where the absenteeism became more. Hospitalizations began with very strange symptoms. They never did figure out, except one time I was in for 3 weeks, and I had a diagnosis of number one, questionable viral hepatitis. Number two, post-withdrawal syndrome of alcohol and drugs. Well, that really should have been number one. And while I was there, every day the doctors would ask me how much I drank. And I gave them the stock answer that I always gave anyone who asked me how much I drank. One or two. Social. Do you take any pills? I said, I take antihistamines in the summer for my hay fever. I was frightened to death that if I really related to someone how much I had been drinking, that they would do to me what my family had done to those two family members who died from alcoholism, and say that I was of low moral character and that I was weak-willed. And I knew that I wasn't. I knew that basically, deep down, I was a very good person. But I couldn't seem to find that person. I couldn't seem to find what it was that I had set out to do with my life because it had fallen apart. I had stopped paying bills. Every time I would try to get to the bank, I'd cash my check before, at the liquor store usually, or at the hospital, and then I'd start buying booze. And before long, the check was gone, and I'd say, well, I'll pay it next Thursday. And next Thursday would come, and the same thing would happen. So I came into the fellowship financially bankrupt. I'm still having trouble getting credit reestablished, but a day at a time it will be. All kinds of things began to happen. Warning notices started coming to me at work that if I didn't shape up, I would be shipped out. And I was deathly afraid of losing my job. I couldn't afford to. I knew that I could probably call upon my brother, as I had called upon him. But I knew I couldn't continue doing that week after week after week. So what happened was I went into a period of control, that I would no longer buy fifths or quarts. I would buy pints. And in that way, I would control how much I drank. And to buy a fifth and a quart from the same liquor store for years, I didn't dare go back there and ask them for a pint. I knew then that that would point a finger that something was wrong with me. So I started hitting all of the neighborhood liquor stores. And, you know, I'd wake up in the morning, and it would be like 7 o'clock, and I'd say, I really don't feel like going in today. And, you know, I had everything from asthma to Susugamushi fever. I'd look up in the Merck manual some way-out disease, and I'd call up in the morning and say, that's what I have. And then I'd wait for 8 o'clock for the liquor store to open. And I'd throw a raincoat on, usually over pajamas, or probably that old nasty moo-moo that I had fallen passed out in the night before. And I'd go around to the liquor store. And have any of you, you know, gone in at 8 o'clock and you feel you have to talk to the clerk? You have to explain why you're there. You can't just go and buy the bottle. You have to look at wines and say, I'm having a dinner party tonight. What wine would be great to serve with whatever? And you go through this Mickey Mouse routine and you end up saying, can I have a pint of whatever it is? And every morning that I would do that, I'd have to go through this same routine of why I was there. You know, he knew why I was there. I didn't really know. Believe me, I think I was the dumbest nurse in New York because 2 and 2 never added up to 4 for me. It always added up to 3 or it added up to 5. But I couldn't see the handwriting on the wall. I would come home and I'd look in my medical textbooks as to what was the matter with me. And I never looked up the disease of alcoholism because I didn't know it was a disease. I'd look up cirrhosis. I'd look up pancreatitis. I'd look up Korsakoff syndrome. And I would identify with some of the symptoms, but I'd always say, I'm not that bad yet, and close up the book and pour another drink. Well, in 1973, it hit me. I went to work one day, having been laid off for a couple of weeks because of an accident that I had at work. I kind of slipped on a dry spot on the floor, and I pulled a muscle in my leg. I was getting very good at that. And I was laid off for a couple of weeks, and all I did was to watch the soap operas and drink. And when I went to go back to work, I went into such a state of withdrawal, I know today it was that I felt at that particular moment I was going to go off the edge of sanity. I had never been so frightened in my entire life because it felt that I was truly any second going to go insane. And I went to my supervisor and I told him that I had to go over to Employees Health and I had to talk to somebody. And I went there and my hand was shaking so badly I couldn't even sign in. You know, it was that kind of thing where you grabbed your wrist and held it close to your body to try and get the name down. And I was finally called in and this guy said to me, what are you here for? And I said, I am drinking too much and I don't know why. I can't seem to stop. And he said, how much are you drinking? And I told him what I had been doing over the past couple of weeks. And you know, he did to me what I thought he would do to me, which was why I never related to anyone before how much I had been drinking. And that was, he went, such a young woman like you. Well, you know, I felt like a penny waiting on change anyway. And I didn't need that turkey to come out with something like that. So he said, you wait right here, and I'm going to call your private physician. And he did, and my private physician slapped me back into the hospital. And I told Al, I said, Al, I want to see a psychiatrist because I'm going crazy. And I don't know about, if you know about the month of August in New York, if it's that way down in West Virginia, but most shrinks go on vacation. They all take off the month of August. But there happened to be a young guy who was just starting his practice, and he was around. And Al got him to come and see me. And we talked. And he called my family, and the family rallied around. They sent an airline ticket to go out to California. Money came to pay for the rent. This came, that cards came, calls came, and all this love and affection. And I felt, Jesus, they were there all along. And he sent me out to the West Coast to rest and recuperate for a month before I went back to work because I was physically in such bad shape. I had stopped eating. I had no appetite at all. I was just skin and bones. You know, I looked like a refugee from one of the concentration camps. And I was to go out there and to really get love and food and the sunshine and get this self together and come back and see him twice a week. And I was to go out there and to really get love and food and the sunshine and get this self together and come back and see him twice a week. Well, I hit Kennedy Airport and I said, I'll have just one drink for the road, you know. And I arrived in Los Angeles a roaring drunk, and I stayed a roaring drunk the whole time I was out there. But I got back to New York and I began to see him. And after about 2 months, he hit me with a question one day that I almost flew out of the chair in having to answer it. And that was, Helen, do you think you're an alcoholic? And I said, oh, no, you know, I know I'm not that bad. I said, I know I'm a heavy drinker, but I come from a family of heavy drinkers, and that's really kind of my cross to bear, you know. And he proceeded to tell me all about Alcoholics Anonymous and that I was wasting money with him, and that's where I should go. Well, you know, it was just before Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving was before Christmas, and Christmas was before New Year's, and that was a bit too rash of a decision to make over the holiday season, because that was my best drinking time, and I wasn't going to have any part of people, you know, as I said at dinner. Alcoholics were people who wore an army overcoat all year, who wore one high tennis shoe and one low tennis shoe, and, you know, the guys had kept their pants up with a clothesline around their waist. And they drank out of a paper bag with some cheap wine. And I still drank top shelf. And I thought that at least I'm not a cheap drunk, you know. Everything was going out. All my money was going out for the booze. But I wouldn't have any part of it. And it wasn't until February 15th of 1974 that I awakened one morning, called in sick again. And I said, the trouble with my life is that it's my job and it's New York City and what I have to do is to leave. But I didn't know where to go. And I didn't know what to do. I was at a total loss. And I thought about the Peace Corps and I thought, well, they don't pay any money. And then I thought about the Hope Ship and I said, well, they're disbanding. And then my ace came right out of my head. And I thought, my God, it's been there all along. I could go into the armed services. That being a nurse, I would go in as an officer. They have those officers' clubs, you know, and happy hour, and the drinks won't be expensive. And maybe I'd meet a nice doctor and get married, and he could take care of me for the rest of my life. And that's about where I was. I saw right then that I could not take care of myself. And I got out the Yellow Pages. And I didn't want the Army because I didn't like the class of people in the Army. I said, it's got to be either the Navy or the Air Force, and besides, they have the nicest bases. And with one eye closed and a ruler, I went down so I could get the numbers straight. And I dialed the recruiting station for the Air Force, and there was no answer. And I dialed it for the Navy, and there was no answer. And I said, well, I'll be damned. Now I have to call the Army. And I dialed the Army, and there was no answer. And at that, I laid back on the bed, and I started to sob. And I cried out to God to please help me. I said, not even the armed services wants me. And I just started to sob. And it was shortly after that that AA came to mind. And I rolled over, and I called Intergroup in New York. And a woman came by to see me. And she said, my God, you need to be in the hospital. And I said, oh, I can't go there. She said, I don't mean where you're working. We have special places for people like you. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, she kind of knocked the arrogance right out of me. She made all of the arrangements. And I sent her across the street to the drugstore to get some toothpaste for me. I think it had been a couple of days since I had brushed my teeth, but I wanted to get her out of the apartment so I could finish up a bottle I had there. And I did that, and I went out to a place in Long Island where I stayed for 7 days. And it was there that I saw the first step. And when I saw that first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable, that a door opened for me. I wondered why it was every morning when I awakened, I said, I'm not going to drink today. And I would get home and say, well, just one to make me unwind a little bit from the day. And then a fifth of scotch would be gone. It was all very clear to me on why I had stopped paying bills, why all of the awful things that had happened to me had happened. And I came out of there and I threw myself, I thought, into AA. And as I said, I stayed sober for 6 weeks. I felt initially humiliated and I felt defeated by being in the hospital, and I thought, has it come to this? And indeed it had come to this, and I thank God it had come to that, because I really don't know where I would be today. I know that I don't know if I'd be alive, and if I were, I'd be behind locked doors someplace. But I drank for 3 more weeks, and it was on the second step, came to believe. And there was a power greater than me that got me back here. I came back because I had no money. I had a check and I was shaking so badly I couldn't sign it. And I called this woman who put me in the hospital and she said, come to my apartment and we'll go to a meeting. And I had to count out 35 pennies. And if you could see this drunk with shaking hands and 35 pennies having to put it in the toll, in the coin thing of a bus, and they fell on the floor, and oh my God, it was awful. But I got back, and I didn't drink that day just by postponing the drink. And then I ran into a woman who I will forever be indebted to, who became my sponsor. And at that time, she had 14 years of sobriety. She just celebrated her 20th anniversary. And she led me down the path. It was not easy, but it was very simple. I didn't drink, and I went to meetings, and I listened. I listened with an open mind. I did things that I didn't want to do, but I believed in what she said and in what the group said when they related their experience that things would be all right. Now, I grew up in a family where we didn't share anything, and you certainly didn't air your dirty linen in public. You kept it all within the family. So this sharing of experience in AA was the most cleansing thing that I had ever felt in my life. Whenever I went into a room, I felt at home. I felt at peace. It might have been an awful day, but I walked into a meeting and I felt a sense of calm come over me. A room full of drunks. Me, who said, no, that's not for me, when the psychiatrist first mentioned it. Coming to AA was like coming home. All my life, I looked for a plan of living. During my active alcoholism, I would sit down and I would say just to the wall or to the ceiling, if you would just tell me what to do, I'll do it. Number one, Helen, do this. Number two, do that. Well, I have found that plan in AA in the 12 steps. It tells me what to do for living a comfortable life. You know, I've tried to stop drinking, and I stopped drinking periodically for Lent. Or I'd go on the wagon occasionally. But I could never stay stopped because something would always come up that the hand would reach out for a drink. I'll show you, usually, you know, a nice big fat resentment in the middle of Lent after I had sworn off for the whole time. But AA has taught me how to cope with sobriety, how to cope with the trials and tribulations of a day. And I must say that even though there have been some bad times in my life in sobriety, I've had a lot of illness. I had 3 major operations. I quit my job, and then I couldn't find another one before my first year. And what it made me do was to reach out to people in AA. And through one particular doctor in AA, she found me a job at her hospital. And I worked there. And I said, I want to work with alcoholics, thinking it was alcoholism treatment. And after a couple of years, LeClaire said to me, now you're ready, but you couldn't do it before. And so I worked in treatment for a while, and I found that, no, that wasn't it. But I was willing to continue because I knew that my higher power had something in store for me. I didn't know what it was, but I believed in that so strongly that I knew that when I was ready for whatever it was, it would come to me. And I said this afternoon that that was a story and a half as to how I got to GSO, because it was just one of those things. Where I was on the beach one day in the summer of 1978, and a staff member passed by, and we got to talking about it. And I thought, well, you know, you have to be more spiritual than God and have more sobriety than Bill W. And they would never have me. And the next day I got to work, and Cora Louise called me, and I returned her call, and she said, can you come on Thursday? And I said, oh, no. You know, I thought to myself, my God, she's a pushy broad. You know? I mean, here it was Monday, and she wanted me to come on Thursday. I had to make arrangements with my own job. And I said, no, darling. I said, I can't come on Thursday. I'll call you when I can. The arrogance. And I hung up the phone, and it was about 2 minutes later that it hit me that, my God, something has presented itself. Why don't you follow through with it? And I did. And I told her I'd be delighted to come. And that was how I got there. You know, we spoke here today about group conscience and electing and so forth and so on. Well, we do the same thing for a staff member at GSO. It's a two-thirds vote. And it's a written ballot because I've been present for a couple of other staff members that we have there. And I thought, my God, did you all go through this when I was being considered for it? You know, I got very nervous. But it's the same process that we go through at GSO as you went through this afternoon or will go through this fall in electing group officers or area officers. Sobriety is a trip for me. Life really, today, when I think back to how it used to be, the strength I had to have to get through a day, that life today is really very easy. You know, I just don't pick up the first drink. And I believe in a power greater than myself. And it's that belief in a power greater than me. And I never in my lifetime until I got to AA thought anything was greater than me. No one, nothing, any kind of way. I didn't disbelieve in God, but I didn't believe either. You know, I was kind of in a state of limbo. And AA has given me a belief in a power greater than myself. And that indeed is what helps me today, by just turning my life and my will over to the care of this power. It makes the day go very easy. I walk down the street getting off the subway. Sometimes I have trouble with that, with coping with the subway. But the Serenity Prayer plays a great deal in my daily life, and it certainly does when I first get up in the morning as I'm walking to work and as I'm waiting for public transportation. But in walking across town to the office, I pray that God helps me today to be a loving and understanding and kind person. And usually when I do that, everything goes along all right. I still have defects of character. I guess I always will. Some will surface, some make themselves known, and when they do, I ask that they be removed. But there are a few I'm still comfortable with, so I kind of hold on to those, you know, for old time's sake. But that sobriety, whoever thought that sobriety could be fun, because I had envisioned it to be a long, gray, narrow tunnel, that life was going to be over without drinking. That's what it's been for me, as I'm sure it's been for many of you. It's coming up to about that time, and I wanted to share with you something which I heard at the conference last year that was read by a retiring trustee, And I think it kind of sums up really what AA has meant for me. And that is, it's a parable where a holy man asked the Lord one day if he could see what heaven and hell are like. The Lord led him to two doors. He opened the first door, and the holy man looked in. In the middle of the room was a very large round table, and in the center of this table was a large pot of stew, which smelled so delicious it made the holy man's mouth water. Then he noticed something odd. In the midst of that plenty, the people sitting around the table were thin and sickly. They appeared to be famished. Looking closer, he saw that while the spoons they were holding had very long handles which enabled them to reach the stew, they were so fashioned that they could only be grasped at the end. And because the handles were longer than a person's arm, it was impossible to get the food back to their mouths. The holy man shuddered at the sight of their misery and suffering. The Lord said, "You have seen hell." They went to the next room and opened the door. It was exactly the same as the first one, the same round table, the same pot of stew. The people, as before, were equipped with the same long-handled spoons. But here the people were well-nourished, and they were laughing, and they were talking. "I don't understand," said the holy man. "It is very simple," said the Lord. "It requires but one skill. You see, they have learned to feed each other." And indeed, I think that's what we have done in AA. And I thank you so much again for having me.